Hi everyone, Sam here. Before we dive into this week's episode, I just want to take a moment to thank everyone who left a review or subscribed, or particularly those who sent the episode to friends who don't already listen to the show. It really does make a big difference, so thanks to everyone who did that. Pledge and I talked this week about some ideas that we have for future episodes. We have a new email address, so anything that you send to hello@golfbadgers.com, we'll look forward to reading.
Good evening, everyone. We've not spoke for a while. We have been releasing some really nice guest podcasts recently, but this one is just us two, isn't it?
It is. We thought we'd try a few different things, didn't we, Bledge? So we've got a new concept of podcast, and Bledge and I are going to be talking about where's Kate Middleton? No, we're not, are we? I think there are enough podcasts.
Jenny,
about...
that's kind of the hot topic in our house as well.
Is Jenny's it?
Got a lot of.
Has she got a theory?
Things,
yeah, I'm sure.
And my deputy actually told me today that Dave Grohl killed Kurt Cobain. So
really,
I was absolutely horrified by that.
Well,
I asked him if he was a flat earther after coming out with nonsense like that.
I think true crime podcast, Bledge, where all the money is, but there are probably enough of them, so we'll just stick to.
I commit enough crimes to greenkeeping.
Well, that's what I keep reading online. You and I both, crimes to architecture, crimes to greenkeeping. So let's just stick in our little corner of the podcasting world.
Yes.
So thank you everyone for listening. My name's Sam Cooper, and if you are one of our more recent listeners, I am a golf course architect. I work with firm of Clayton DeVries and Pont. And whilst you might not know me, you probably will know Bledge. So what's your background, Bledge? Just remind people.
So, yeah, I'm James Bledge. I'm a links manager at Royal Liverpool. And Sam and I go back probably about 4 years now, I think, we have been friends for. And
yeah,
2 years professionally. And I think we're up almost into episode 30 of this podcast now. I think so. So it's been going okay, but we just thought we'd have a kind of a restock and see what people liked and what they didn't like, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more in the second half of this podcast. Is that right, Sam?
That's absolutely correct. And just for the people who don't make it all the way through to the second half, I think that it is something that we'd really like to encourage you to do, is to actually, if you are able to spare the time to jot a little email or send us a message on social media, the kind of podcast that you like. Well, they can find you. What are you, James Bledge, at James Bledge on Twitter and Instagram?
At James Bledge, yes.
And I'm SD Cooper, SD underscore Cooper on the site formerly known as Twitter. And I'm Links from the Road on Instagram. But we also, now, Bledge, very exciting development, after 2 and a bit years of doing the podcast, we have an email address. Do you know that? We have.
I actually don't know.
So people can now send an email to hello@golfbadgers.com. It's professional, isn't it?
That's really good.
So if you fire an email in and tell us what you like, tell us the kind of episodes that you've enjoyed so far. In the second half of this pod, we're going to talk about some ideas we have for other pods. So please do think of those, think of what you've enjoyed, and let us know, because if you like it, we'll make some more of them. And if you don't like us, tell us that as well, because it's important that we bring stuff that does add a bit of value. And I think that's been the case, Bledge, with our recent guest pods, hasn't it?
Yeah, we've had some crackers recently. Yeah, and we've got two more coming up.
Yeah,
is that right?
Two more
that
we've already recorded,
ready to put out. But yeah, I mean, shout out to the Roberts Brothers, which I really enjoyed doing. Even though I was ridiculously hungover, same as Andy Ewens. They've been great fun to do. I think Andy had a a really serious story to tell. You know, it was really insightful.
Well, I thought the Andy one especially. There was so many responses to that, weren't there? I don't know how many messages you got, Bledge, but I got tons from people who said they never thought that they would enjoy three blokes talking about heather, the plant, for quite as long as we ended up chatting about it and how engrossed they got in the subject. And and I think that was definitely the case. That's what the podcast sort of allows us to do. It allows us to be very nerdy. And people who have never really thought of what goes into building or maintaining a golf course, but take it for granted maybe, I think we've encouraged a few people at least to think a little more deeply about the subject matter. And hopefully there'll be a few more people out there who also pick up the podcast and also get that degree of insight. Because for those of us who work in the greenkeeping golf industry in general, I think that that's only a good thing. The more people who know the hard work that goes in behind the scenes, the better life can be for all of us as a result. So thank you for listening to those and for getting in touch. But we've got a few other things. It's not just the interviews between Bledge and I that we'll talk about in a minute. But before we do, Bledge...
We had I'm going to give a shout out actually to one of the biggest Badger fans that I often get a message about, and more recently someone that listened to Adrian Mortram's one all the way through, having not a greenkeeper, one of our members, Chris Brand.
Oh, Brandy.
Yes.
Well,
so he loved Adrian's one, which was pretty cool because it's not his forte at all, is it really?
No, well, but I think there's crossover, isn't there, in people's lives. So Brandy's a surveyor, amongst other things, building surveying. And I think that people probably recognize aspects of their own jobs and what they have to do within the various roles that go into golf. And if you are
maybe golfer, he just likes penguins.
I think that's probably just as much of the case.
I think you're reading too much into it. I think it's got nothing to do with his job. It's just the fact that he's into penguins. Well, maybe Chris, you could get in touch and let us know.
There you go. hello@golfbadges.com. You know where to find us.
Yeah, that's the first one.
Well,
good. So what have you been up to then, Sam?
Well, my busy period, Bledge, is slowly coming to an end, which is quite exciting. I've had few projects, long writing projects in the search over the winter, but perfect time to be doing it, you know, when the nights are dark and it's raining outside, then you may as well be inside, mightn't you, and you know, badgering away, and that's what I've been doing. So the book series is coming along and I'm quite excited now because I think volume one is probably about just over a month away from actually hitting the shelves in Britain. So I'm really excited.
Volume one of 18.
Of 18. We'll probably be cancelled before 18. But we certainly
read volume one and two on the plane.
Yes. So you read the Aquatrols version.
I enjoyed them.
Of it. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we.
So what's the difference between the Aquatrols version and the one that's getting published now?
This one you've got to pay for. No, there's a bit more than that. They're completely different, actually. So this one and so much work has gone into it. There's been about 10 different people between the publishers and on my side of things, sort of working on it and, you know, editing the photographs properly. And
so there's a lot more photographs in it than
there are a few more photographs, but this one has, we hope, all being well, illustrations. Which sounds a little odd, but wait till you see them, Bledge. You know, they are unbelievable. It looks so beautiful. So yeah, lots of work has gone into it, to the design. And I really, really am excited for it because it's just a beautiful version of the same, you know, it's the same text by and large and most of the same photographs, but it's just been so beautifully put together. I wanted something that felt nice, looked nice, and you know, spent 2 years in the van going around seeing these courses, and it's such a big part of my life and such a big thing that we were lucky enough to do. I wanted to do justice by the courses, really, and if we were going to do it, I wanted to do it right. So, yeah, a lot of work's gone into it, and it's taken a long time, but volume one, I think the next 6 weeks, middle of May. No, actually, what's that? That's only half. Yeah, 6 weeks or so, mm-hmm. beginning of May, I think it will probably be out, and watch this space. I'll let people know on the podcast, but social media definitely. And
it's something that's completely different to anything we've had before, really. I mean, it's no golfer's journal and no links diary. It's completely outside of that. It's got its own niche. So I was, and I'm not being biased, but I was thoroughly impressed with it. I really enjoy it. And I don't often read anything from start to finish. I'm not a big reader.
No.
Never have been.
Golden House
However,
Menu.
I did read Nomad.
Well, the great Partridge is the greatest writer of them all, and I can't compete with him. Mm. Thank you, mate.
Actually, the best. Yeah, but you're the Partridge of golf. So, but yeah, no, it's going to be thoroughly exciting. It'll be really cool. And if you're listening to this, there's a discount code with this goes with this.
Yeah, 10% extra.
10% on if you mention.
Well, what have you been up to, Bledge? Because the first thing I want to talk about on this episode properly is, you know, we're joking aside, spring does kind of feel like it's just around the corner now. And every golf course, I think, in Great Britain this winter has been wetter than probably it ever has been before. So as golfers and Green Committee members and greenkeepers listening to this, what are the things that you're working on now at Hoylake as we move from the winter towards the spring to make sure the golf course is ready for the imminent influx of golfers when the finer weather does appear?
Well, I think we've been hit hard this winter. There's no doubt about it, especially coming off the back of the Open. However, I think it's spare a thought for all these guys on clay, Partland golf courses. And if ever a chance, if any golfers listen to this or any board member of a Partland golf course, if ever there's time to kind of lay off your greenkeeper or greenkeepers, it's going to be going into this spring because it's just been horrendous. I mean, I think I looked the other day, 266 mil since the 1st of January, and that was the norm, really, which is working out at 3 mil of rain a day. And it's just constantly topping up the aquifers and the water tables. And
put that into context,
water just
Reg,
can't get away in time.
What would you ordinarily expect at Hoylake where we are over that period? Do you know?
Probably less than half that, I would have really? Thought. Yeah, I mean, we were up at 1.2 or 1.3 meters last year, and we usually at Hoylake it's about 600, so it's been double the amount. I mean, luckily we're on sand, but still we have got areas of the water table that are so high that I mean, let's take for the front, anyone knows Hoylake, the front left of the first green, two little dips there that I heard this week were put in by Hawtrey.
They were recently. I thought they were Steele, but maybe they were Hawtrey.
No, maybe it was Donald Steele then. Yeah, maybe
They're definitely one of the best changes to the golf course in the last sort of 30 years in terms of like just a real subtle tweak that makes a massive difference to how that hole plays. Like accentuates the strategy of the hole. I think just a great example of how you don't need to, you know, do crazy stuff to make a big difference to a hole. But yes,
I thought they were natural because they actually look quite good. They don't look like they've been put
well,
in.
There you go, sign
unlike of. Some of the kind of the broken ground up the side of some of the holes. But they have laid in water since November.
Yeah.
So today they were pulled out and raised by, after you saying how good they were, we raised them by about a foot to try and take them out of the water table.
Oh, it doesn't make a difference.
I mean, it's not much, no. But
you need that wedge because from a player's perspective, the whole point, if people will probably know that hole, it's such a famous hole with playing 90 degrees around the practice ground, out of bounds or down the right. because it's normally our first hole of the day, and probably your typical Hoylake member has arrived slightly later to the club than they would have anticipated, and rather than going and warming up on the practice range, they might have gone to the bar for a drink instead. It means that you're not really at full ability when you hit your first two shots of the day on the first. So naturally, you don't want to go out of bounds. You end up being left off the tee and then short left off the second shot. So that's why this little depression there is so important, because it just means when you inevitably have played two conservative shots, you then have to play your little pitch or chip or approach or whatever through it or over it, and make a decision. Do you run it? Do you land it in there? Do you stun it into the bank? Do you hit a lofted shot over the top? And therefore, you know, they need to be dry at the bottom, because otherwise you've removed three out of those four options and you can only loft it. So it's so important.
It's such a bottleneck as well, you know, that to have it fenced off, then you're just putting all the traffic right on the core of the green, which brings a load of new problems as well. I mean, I can imagine that'll be infested with ryegrass come the summer as well. So, I mean...
Because you're concentrating, a few patches concentrating like that, foot traffic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's it's just such a small area. But, I mean, we've had major problems this year with our range, with the water table, drainage that's 30 plus years old that completely needs renewed and raised up, because it's obviously climate change has never been as apparent as what it is now. There's absolutely no denying it anymore. You can't argue it, it's a fact. So we're really putting a plan in place to make sure that I want this place dry by the next open, you know, 5 to 7 years time, everything drained. So it's a 12-month a year playable golf course, no matter how wet the winters get. So draining the water table, all the bunkers. So we'll see what happens, if that's achievable or not. That's what we hope for. That's what we're proposing. So it's ambitious but doable, and I think something that kind of befits a course of this stature. I don't think you'd want to settle for anything less. So aim high.
Bledge, can I ask?
Can I ask?
Obviously, if a golf course is wet, you know, I take the point. Sand's great because it allows the water to pass through it. But then, if it's saturated, if it's at capacity, if there's nowhere for the water then to go, then it doesn't matter whether you're on sand or clay or concrete. You know, if it's full, it's full. So, what are the other problems of a course like Hoylake being wet for too long? Obviously, any surface water or bunkers being out of play are self-evident. But, you know, agronomically, what other things that people might not necessarily think of are affected by a very damp surface?
I think the thing that's kind of been most obvious this year is the thinning out of the sward. You can look into the greens more. You know, there's they're not as dense, and with that you get ingress of moss or potentially more poanya, a plant that loves water at the surface for the shallow rooting. I'm maybe being a little bit pessimistic, but I mean they definitely won't be as strong as what they have been going into years previous with having drier winters. So although they did look quite good today, you know, we've been doing a lot of remedial work on them to kind of try and fight back, which we can discuss a little bit. But yeah, that's probably the biggest thing. You know, disease pressure is obviously higher with wetter greens, and I mean, there's a dozen greens here that are built of heavier material that hold water as well. So another issue that needs looked at. So been doing a bit of investigating about that, having all this material tested just to kind of get it clear in our head exactly infiltration rates and saturated hydraulic conductivity rates. So lots of great stuff to do, you know, and I think it's, for me, it's actually quite exciting that there is stuff to do.
That's an interesting...
Keep on making it better every year.
Can we just... maybe go back to what you just said there about the the different methods of green construction through the years, and how that affects you and your job as a course manager in 2024. Is it worth? I probably know the history of when some of them were done, and we don't have many. In fact, I don't think we have any at all greens now that were what I'd call original. So Hoylake was 1869 when it was laid out as a 9-hole course. And funnily enough, the courses that do have really, really old greens, Ali Beggs was telling me that often they're some of the ones that perform best of all. So it's not necessarily just the case, is it, Bledge, that the older the greens are, they have to be rebuilt. He was saying the old
it's not an age thing, no.
Greens, which are just pure sands, you know, they perform drainage wise, everything as not perfectly, I'm sure, but by and large, better than so many greens that have been built in the centuries since them. But the reason why, am I right in saying greens that were built probably between the wars. Probably of an era where, in Hoylake's case, it was Harry Colt who came and made revisions in sort of 1923, 1924. And he took all of our greens, or a lot of our greens, from low points. You know, greens that were built at the bottom of the sand dunes or in the sort of gullies and depressions to catch water and have a better chance of growing grass. He sort of tried to build a green in a different way, which gave him more opportunity to build a green on top of a sand dune, which he did on the 8th hole at Hoylake, the great par 5 into the corner, or the 10th, which was actually, I don't think it was Colt, I think it was slightly before him, I think it was Hilton actually, but with the same principle. And then the 11th and the 12th, those great holes that Colt worked on there. But Bledge, if you've been doing a bit of coring and stuff into the greens, what's the difference between one of those greens and the way you might look to build a green if you were building it from scratch nowadays?
So if we start with the most recent ones, I mean, so if we're looking at members rooting 2, 5 and 15, the three recent ones are built in pure sand with a root zone mix. So the root zone mix would probably be like a 1 part compost, 3 parts sand. You know, when I say compost, as in like a loamy, root zoney topsoil that stripped off the top, which is ideal. These perk really fast, 60, 70 mil an hour, which is pretty fast. I think USG.
You want to get the water away. You want to get the water away.
Yeah. I think USG spec. It's like 140 or something like that, but someone can probably correct me on that because I honestly don't think that's right. But it won't be far off. But that's really coarse sand, you know. That's stuff that's like you watch the American PGA Tour events where the green's completely flooded, and then an hour later it's dry again and it's playable. That's like USGA spec and super high perk greens. I mean, ours with 60, and that's without the kind of thatch layer. That's just the sand itself. So you think that's 60 millimetres in an hour, which you don't really get 60 millimetres an hour. So they're very good draining greens. And then you can, we have the next bunch of greens, which would be like 17, 18, 3, 4, I think, something like that. Would that be right?
Always in the 60s, but there's others.
They still perform really well. Yeah. And they've been built and they perform well. And then we have what we call the old greens, 7, 8, 9, that kind of run. And actually, myself and my first assistant, Chris Trimble, we took some hexi plugs out on this week and then put the hole changer in at 2 depths. And it's really nice for the top 150 mil. And then after that, 250 mil worth, down to the 400 mil, 250 mil of, it's not clay. We kind of thought that these dew ponds were built with clay, but it's just a really, really heavy soil, really compacted heavy soil. And we kind of knew this from, I put an 8 mil tine on them about a month ago and they started snapping. all about 7-8 inches. Try to get them really deep, assist to the boys. Let's get them really deep. Just try and get down to, I've got my ruler here actually, which comes out with us. Let's try and get them down to 9 inches if we can. I mean, that's right down to the very bottom. And they all snapped.
Really?
So like, well, that's, does that makes me not, that makes me want to try something bigger and break through that. And that's telling me that it's super compacted. When you dig it out, you could see it was heavy and shiny. I'll send you some pictures. But so we went with a 13 mil tine at the same depth, and we broke into that with no heave on it at all. So just straight in and straight out. But at the bottom of this 400 on the eighth green, especially seventh and eighth, straight in the sand. So sand's obviously drainable. So, and the eighth sits up quite high. So if it's the wettest green in the course, you know, it had to be cut 4 or 5 times in the open.
Well, I think that is
the wet mornings.
That's the point that I'm sort of keen to make here, Ledge, isn't it? That nowadays, if you're building a green, you want to build a surface that allows the water to drain as quickly as you need away.
As you need, exactly. Aye. So not quickly as possible, quickly as you
as
need.
Quickly as you want.
Because you want to still retain moisture and nutrient. But the thing I'm thinking now, I've got in my head, and people might want to get in touch with their experience of it, I'd be willing to hear, but I've been looking at the drill and fill, because you can drill down. It's like a corkscrew drill that drills and pulls out a core, and you fill it with pure sand. So you can drill and connect a drainage channel to a permeable layer below it, 450 mil.
But the reason
so that could certainly send the water down faster without having to swap the green out, because I mean you're looking at £25,000-£30,000 to swap every green out, and a hell of a disruption.
But the reason you have that layer there to make the point is, in the '20s they didn't have irrigation, did they? So
yeah,
their
sensible
objective then was actually the exact reverse of what it is today, or near enough. To actually do the exact opposite and stop the water from running away. And some places, as you say, they did that with clay, certain places. But I think another popular method was lime, wasn't it? Like a rich mix of heavy, you know, of basically soil. And I'm pretty sure Mackenzie used to write about putting a sort of lime mix down, like a potash sort of mix thing, which basically got the mix together.
Keep talking. Oh. Keep talking. I've just remembered what's in the office here.
Oh, you
hold
found
on,
something.
Take my headphones off.
They're just on a mission.
If this ever does go out on video, I've got the bucket of truth here, Sam.
So, audio description time. Bledge has come back with a big orange bucket, and he's pulled out a... What is it, Bledge?
This is a core. This is the core. But just to kind of show you how heavy it is inside, how much it weighs. I mean, the bulk density of this must be huge.
It looks like it's black.
I mean, even pulling it apart. I mean, there are black things in it, you know? Even pulling it apart, it's so tight.
Is it like grainy? Is it almost like coal or something?
Well, no. It's not that black. No, I mean this is actually probably the better part of it, because the worst part we sent away to Charnet European Turf Laboratories to test. I mean, see how it's sticking to my finger there, almost like clay. Clay would usually do that. You can mold it. Look, you're molding it. It's a way to get tested just now. We'll test it for particle size, particle shape, because I mean, the shape's a big thing as well. Because if you've got sand shape that interlocks, you know, it's not spherical or like rounded, it's angular and they lock together like a jigsaw, then you definitely don't get any water coming through. So it costs about 130 quid or something like that to get tested. It's worth every penny because it's great ammunition. I really love to justify everything I do, and I've just done a massive report on it to take to the board, and I want to actually show them the data and show them the real life figures and say, look, this the greens that drain well perk at 60 mil an hour. I would I'm going to guess these are about 7 or 8, if that, maybe even 5. I don't think water's getting through there at all. Hence the reason why we put a big spike through them.
You raise another good point there, I think, with actually quantifying that. That's something that I spend a lot of my time in the architecture world actually doing pledges. So it's going away and saying, well, yes, we want to do X, Y, and Z for the golf course for these reasons. And I always maintain, you know, you should never be doing anything for the sake of doing anything. It should only be at the demonstrable betterment of the golf course as a whole. But also, I think that actually quantifying what you're maintaining at the moment and what you are maintaining in our proposed version. So often we're taking, as an example, bunkers away from courses. And we've talked about this a lot before and we won't get into it here. But if you actually work out how much time you spend on X, Y, and Z, and then you look at the cost of fixing it, which gives you all of the improvements because you'll, as a golfer, in the case of the green here, have a better putting surface, and wouldn't that be nice? But Bledge, I reckon if you were to go away and say how much extra work goes into, on an annual basis, maintaining that eighth green because you've got to micromanage it, well, that's going to slow you down, isn't it? That's going to take more time, more resource. If you actually work that out and quantify it, you could be able probably to put a numbers figure to it saying, well, this is how much it will cost to fix it. There's this option, this option, this option. And this is my forecast on the quantifiable benefits of doing so. You know, we'll get this much better in terms of playing conditions, but we'll also save X number of hours a week because we're not having to micromanage it and spend longer on it, and that adds up to X number of wages. So, you know, this is what we can spend on fine tuning the rest of the golf course. Do you sort of look at it in that way? So,
all the time. It's one of the biggest jobs our modern course managers' justification, whether it be exactly what you've talked about there, or swapping the machine out, etc. So, I mean, for a club like this that has a lot of elite golf, big championships, you know, obviously just done the Open, but every year we've pretty much got something on, then these guys got to tell the difference between the speed on the eighth green and the speed on the fifth. You know, it'd be night and day, they're a foot faster. So we need to double cut that of a morning, we need to double roll it. And that obviously brings its own stresses as well, because there's double the amount of turning, double the amount of passes. So it's not ideal. You know, we live in an ideal world, and we can't clip the fingers here and just financially kind of make everything happen. It doesn't work like that either. A lot of folks probably think it does, but it's not. It's far from it. In fact, you know, there's a lot of things to pay for here. But yeah, I quite like that side of the job, though. I like putting the reports together and justifying stuff. I was kind of brought up well at Royal Cinque Ports with James Lear doing stuff like that. You know, me and him would work a lot on reports, and we got what we wanted because you're presenting a bit of literature to an educated board or guys that receive these reports, whether it be in banking or medical or law. And that's the language you speak in. So it's as opposed to going to them and saying, oh, we need to swap them greens out. They want to see the data. They want to see the proof. They want to see the proof from recognised companies such as ETL.
They want to know why. Exactly, yeah. And I think this is, I have the same thing. When we're doing our reports, and that could be for green committees or for memberships or whatever it may be, you know, if I can't hand on heart stand up in front of a baying membership and say, if they were to say, why do you want to get rid of that bunker? Why do you want to move that green? Why do you want to do this, that, and the other? If I can't answer that question and say, well, the reason for it is this, or X, Y, and Z, and they say, well, how much does it cost? How much is this going to cost? How much disruption? You know, if you haven't thought about all of those things, if you just waltz in and say, this is what you should change, and they say, why? And you say, oh, well, because I think it's a good idea. Or the one I hate is because, oh, I think it will frame the hole nicely, or it gives something to aim at. Well, that's bollocks. You know, if anyone says that, then they should be strung up. You know, there's a reason for doing things. And if you can't actually make that case clearly, then you probably shouldn't be suggesting us in the first place. That's something that I've always had drummed into me, and feel quite passionately
you
about.
You get torn to shreds. You know, it's like Dragon's Den, isn't it? When the people that succeed at Dragon's Den know their stuff. If Big Debs Meaden's on your board, or Simon Theopophetus, remember him? You know, I get torn to shreds of him about. Yes, about infiltration rates. But it's the same. You did a talk at my home club the other week.
I did. So the
can
next.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I think we can now. Yeah.
We've been wanting to talk about this for a while, actually, because obviously it's a place I played a lot of my junior golf there. I'm a member again since moving back up here, which is great. I'm actually playing it on Saturday morning.
Are you lucky boy? Yeah, that's
not been home since November, so.
Well, fair enough then. Let's talk a little bit about Southern S. So I first played Southern S. I can't remember when exactly in my tour it was. I'd like to say 2020, something like that. I played Silloth on the other side of the Solway Firth years and years and years ago, because Silloth is, you know, one of I think it's the most northerly links in England, just before you then cross over the border. And almost looking at it from the other side of the Solway Firth is Southern S.
The better side.
Well, you know what, Bledge? It's just my style of golf as well. I love Southern S. So the first time
I'm more just kind of just referring to the whole Scotland England thing, but like there's no, well, if anyone is still listening.
When I gave my talk at Southern S, I was able to say, you know, you've got the best view in Scotland. Nowhere else can they look out over the water and have such a beautiful view of England. So I got a bit of a stick for that one. but it is a gorgeous spot, isn't it? And I think that of all the golfing locations in Scotland, you know, your Ayrshires on the west coast, or your East Lothians and your Fifes and Highlands or Aberdeenshire, all of those sorts of classic places where there are a glut of great, great golf courses. Respectfully, that's not the case in Dumfries and Galloway, is it? You know, you've got Halfoot as you drive past. But Southern S is fantastic. And the real interesting thing about it as a golf course is, and I don't think many people realize this, is, you know, you had this great period for golf. And it was, generally speaking, between the two world wars. And that's when, if you look at any list, if I encouraged anyone listening to this podcast to write down their 10 favorite courses or 50 courses they'd most like to play, then I bet the majority of them were either built or rebuilt during that really short little period in reality, you know, between the First World War, start of the Second World War. That was the golden age of architecture. And it's when you had the likes of Harry Colt and Alistair McKenzie and Simpson and Fowler and all of these guys doing their real best work. And it's no coincidence that such a disproportionate number of courses that are on anyone's wish list are from that little area. And then, you know, things changed. Even before the Second World War, course construction started to reduce. You know, after the Roaring Twenties, you had the Great Depression, and then real slowdown in the 1930s, and then end of the 30s, you're into the Second World War, and then the country took a little while to recover after the Second World War, and then you end up in this sort of globalizing industrial world of when you get into the 50s and 60s, and then you think of the golf courses built in that era, and they were really American-style courses influenced from everything that was going on in the world, and big machinery existed and people had cars, and that, you know, the courses that were built were generally of an American style with a big name architect. And, you know, respectfully, some people will love those and say they're their favorite type of golf, but it's not my favorite type of golf. My favorite type of golf, unfortunately, stopped being built for a long time because those strategic ideals were sort of yesterday's ideals for a while. Fortunately, that's not the case anymore at all, but it was for a long period. But the reason I said all of that is Southern S was a real anomaly because it was built after the Second World War. I think it was 1947. However, it was built by an architect who was very, very much of that interwar period, a bloke called Philip Mackenzie Ross. And Mackenzie Ross, nothing to do with Alistair Mackenzie or Donald Ross, but Mackenzie Ross, he worked for many years as the foreman of Tom Simpson, my absolute favourite architect. And I'm pretty sure he worked on New Zealand Golf Club down near Woking and quite a few others of that ilk. And Mackenzie Ross, after the Second World War, sort of rebuilt the ELSA course at Turnberry, because that had been taken over by the Air Force, of course. And he built, or he made big changes to Castletown on the Isle of Man. But he built Southern Esk from scratch, and it's magnificent. And it's not big dunes, and it's not flash, and it's not in your face, but it's bloody classy. And it's subtle, and it's an unbelievable, you know, sort of rolling, proper links ground. And, you know, we were invited to consort there as architects, and it was just such a real, real pleasure. But we felt the significance of the site acutely. You know, you don't want to be coming in, as I said before, and making change for the sake of change. But, you know, like everywhere, it was designed for an era that no longer exists. You know, we're not playing with the balls and the golf clubs of 1947. We're playing with spaceships on the end of a graphite shaft and the ball that goes, you know, 10%, 20% further than that. So it's crazy that the course wouldn't have changed, but that fortunately is the case. But it means then that those courses that were designed to, the bunkers were meant to be in the way of the longest hitters, well, now the longest hitters hit straight over the top of them. And the shorter hitters, who were meant to have an easier route, well, they're now in all the bunkers that were put there for the best players. So, you know, we in every course of that era, if you're going to re-examine it, you need to do it with, I think, you know, through the eyes of the original architect. What was he trying to achieve? What was the idea? What was each hole? What questions were they trying to ask you? And how can you take those principles and apply them in a similar way, being respectful of their sort of their design ideals and their style? How can you do that in the modern way that's economical for the club to maintain and brings back the original design ideals? So that was the idea. And yeah, I presented those suggestions to the membership there probably 2 or 3 weeks ago now.
So would you like to talk about the two biggest changes? The two you probably know what I'm thinking of.
Or the controversial ones. I do know. So well, I wouldn't say yeah, for the most part.
I think
no, I wouldn't good. Either. Actually, I say that slightly tongue in cheek because any change to a routing, you know, I think that I liken it to if you're buying a house, you know, the routing is the postcode. That's the thing you can't change easily, and if you want to change it, it's expensive. You know, so we live on the Wirral. A good routing is like living in Caldy or Heswell or, you know, on Pinfold Lane, bottom of Pinfold Lane. You know, it's the road. It's the best road that you can afford. That's what the routing is. And it shouldn't be messed around with lightly. However, a lot of courses were designed to have holes along boundaries and, you know, there'll be new houses built and gardens and new roads and maybe they sold some lands and, you know, inevitably the passage of time means that perhaps the routing as it was no longer makes complete sense. So you've got to reconsider it in a way that does respect the original ideals. The other side is, you know, if the routing is the neighborhood, the individual elements of the hole, you know, where the tiers, even where the greens are to a degree, but as soon as you start moving greens, you're really moving the routing. But certainly tees, because there's a great deal of elasticity in tees, are the easiest element of a hole to change, which is why most places have lengthened their courses by whacking the tees as far back as they can. Whether that's a good idea or not is a separate question in itself. But tees, bunkers, mowing lines, you know, the trees and gorse bushes, if it's a Lynx course, that, you know, those kind of things, that's like refurbishments. That's buying a house and getting an architect in to either give it a bit of elephant's breath on the wall and a new kitchen from B&Q, or you can, dare I say, do it properly. You can decorate, you can redecorate, or you can sort of properly do it, and maybe that's a touch of rewiring, maybe you're not going to do a bit of a knock through, but you are changing those elements. So half of the report is the bunkering and the tees and all that kind of stuff, the mowing lines, the easy stuff, the refurbishment stuff. But in the case of Southern S, what we found when we were looking at all the old aerials and doing our homework and our research was the clubhouse was originally designed to be down by the lighthouse. Not exactly by the lighthouse, but for anyone who's played Southern S, the clubhouse was effectively designed to be on the banks of the Solway Firth. And you started on hole number one back in the day, which was a wide, flat, straightforward par four that, you know, allowed players to get away, hit a drive without worrying too much, and then hit another shot and you know, get on the golf course and get moving and be efficient as a starting hole. And then you played all the way around, and then you come back, you sort of navigate through the nice, interesting land, then you go on this big loop around the fields in the middle, and then you sort of build up and up and up to the extraordinary, this sort of closing run of holes, which climaxes on the hole, the most incredibly beautiful hole bledge, isn't it? The going all the way down to the banks of the Solway Firth.
12th.
And that used to be the 17th. Exactly. But now it's the 12th. So that used to be the 17th. It was the pinnacle of the round. And then you stood on what was the 18th tee, again, perched on the edge of the water, and you played a hole back to the clubhouse. That was for the first 30 years, 25, 30 years of the club's life. That was the routing. But then the hotel that was meant to be built alongside the clubhouse down there didn't happen. They sold it for houses to be built instead. And they built a new clubhouse, which was between the fifth green and the sixth tee. And that's the clubhouse that's there right now. So the entire flow of the course, you know, the build up to this climax, just didn't work anymore, because the hole that was the 17th is now the 12th. So the purpose that little corner of the course once served no longer exists, and now it actually works against the routing of the course, because you have the great climax and then a big anti-climax afterwards. So, you know, I had this idea for what about after the 12th and you're on a complete high, rather than turning away from the water, you've played a short par four right along the edge of the banks of the Solway Firth, because there are plenty of long par fours at Southern S, but a bit of variety in the whole yardage wouldn't go amiss. And that was a nice way, I thought, of making better use of the water, better use of the land, doing it in a way that didn't interfere with the SSSI boundary, which runs variously around the site. So it's completely outside of any of that. And then not only do you have a short hole, but then you can have a long par five, three-shot par five, because the par fives there at the moment are all kind of quite short and all down prevailing wind.
Yeah, they're more hittable, definitely. And I mean, having a drivable par four, everyone loves that.
Well, exactly. It's one of the... Clates always reminds me, it's one of the few hole types that have got better because of the ball going further. The fact that a short par four is playable for more people. And, you know, people do like it. People like opportunities where something can go well, or if they don't get it right, something can, you know, their mate who's tried to bite off more than he can chew can make a fool of himself. Because that's fun. That's why we play golf. It's the risk and reward and the enjoyment. Mm-hmm. So that was the idea. We've got to get the final quotes in and they're voting on it finally. But they voted on the night on the proposals in general, and it went pretty well. So I was pleased.
I hope it goes through. You know, change is good, and I mean, I've seen the plans that you and Joe have knocked up. They're just world class. They look fantastic. And I can't wait to be a part of it as well and play them if they're made, hopefully, fingers crossed. That kind of whole area holds a lot of fond memories for me. It's the first time I ever drove a car. I was in the Southern S Beach as well. Because you used to be able to...
Was it? Could you drive?
You used to be able to drive from the lighthouse all the way around to the 12th Green and right away along there. My mate Fraser Stirling had a, I think it was a red or a white Fiat Panda, and we used to listen to Limp Bizkit or Hole, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Full Blast, along flying doing donuts along there. But now it's all rocks, which is weird, you know. It just shows you how much it's changed. But I've stood there and with my dad and watched cars being taken out to sea because of tides coming so fast. And people really? Haven't been prepared. And the next thing, the car's floating and it's getting taken out. And the guys... Aye, so a lot of good memories along there.
It was like that on Southport Beach. That was the one near here that you used to be able to drive your car on.
Mm.
You know, I can't remember where exactly. It's somewhere near Birkdale. There's one of those roundabouts down on the coast road there. You used to be able to drive onto the beach.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I've got a permit to take the truck.
Didn't see a car floating away, though.
No, you'd be scared if that happens. But yeah, it used to happen. People from Dumfries that are listening to this will understand that. It's true. God, I used to shoot hundreds around Southern Ness and south of Scotland, Dumfriesshire Championships. And next year's captain, Clark Riddick, one of my old heroes.
Great. He's your golfing idol, isn't he, Patch?
You bring
him up about once every other week, I think.
I know, he's great. He's great Ridder, so top big Queen of the South fan as well. So, yeah, that's exciting stuff, Sam. So
yeah, no, it's great fun. I'm looking forward to hopefully, fingers crossed. We'll get it over the line and get it built. And you know, we've designed it in such a way that it's really affordable because we can build it out of play and carry on playing the existing holes, all that kind of stuff. Because that's all matters, you know. You can't, like we said before, it's got to work. It's got to be deliverable for the context of the club, their finances, all of those kind of things as well. So we've worked hard in that regard. But it's exciting to see. But I think that if anyone's listening to this podcast who hasn't played Southern S, then, you know, shame on you. Have you got the bell, Bledge? Ring the bell. Shame bell.
With the Open coming up as well this year.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's the thing. I think, okay, it doesn't have half a dozen courses of, you know, of equal standing alongside it. But what it does have is it's hell of a convenience if anyone's driving from England to, like you say, to the Open to play golf before, after the Open this year. I'm sure there'll be no shortage of golfers going to Ayrshire.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's the... All you do is you drive, you wave at the sign, welcome to Scotland sign, and then you turn left, don't you? And it's like an hour turning left, and then you're playing the golf course, and depending what time you set off in the day, if you're driving north, then you're probably going to arrive there after lunch, and the golf course is probably going to be empty. Because maybe not every day, but often the afternoons when I'm there, it's so quiet. So to be able to break up the journey, play a golf course that's undervalued categorically. I don't know what the green fee is, but if it was somewhere else in the country, it would be a hell of a lot more.
Well, I mean, it certainly will be a fraction of the price. Whilst we're still speaking, I can look that up, Sam, because I have my work computer in front of me.
Good. Well, I think that's the point. So that's our little plug for Southern S. Go and see it.
Great greenkeeper down there as well. Let's talk about Neil Hamilton.
Yeah, well,
Neil Hamilton and I grew up together since we were I was five and he was six, or whatever. We used to go to the same primary school together.
Nelly's older than you, Bledge.
I know.
He looks 10 years younger than you.
Because he's like a vampire. He looks like Ronaldo.
I think he's a Rory McIlroy lookalike when he's got his hat on. But he's got the course in magnificent shape, and it's pure, absolutely pure. So there you go. Go and play Southern S, and Bledge will tell you shortly how much you can play it for.
Well, I was going to tell you shortly, but I've clicked on green fees and nothing's come up. Nothing's come up. So, yeah, well, southernsgolfclub.com. Have a look.
And they're working.
Maybe Sam can put some...
we'll put it in the show notes.
Show notes,
but that's top tip. Well, Bledge, I'd like to just quickly, before we come and talk about our future podcasting, just circle back and say, what else is in your spring program then? You know, what's the difference as you go from, say, February to into April? How does your day differ? You know, what as we as golfers, what should we start to look out for? What should we get excited about? What should we start noticing as the grass starts growing again?
So reverting back to, we've got the Southern Nest tee times in, and then we'll go to that question.
Oh, you cracked.
So the open week is, right, so here, 22nd of July. So it can't be far from that, I don't think. Oh, 22nd, it's the week after. So the week of would be, the week starting the 15th. The 15th. So tee times there are from £65 through the week.
They're not.
Through the week, £65. Yeah, £65. Half.
They can't be.
Half three at night is £65. And then in the morning, so in the busier times, it's 90.
Well, there you go. That is bargain of the century. So hopefully some Badgers will go and play that.
At weekends, it's off peak time 75 and on peak time is 100. I mean, it's crazy.
That's ridiculous.
£100 you overspend.
Yeah. That's ridiculous.
So,
okay. Well,
yeah, going back to your question, sorry. This time of year, we kind of touched on it earlier, especially the wet, and we probably digressed a little bit, but you'll find that a lot of greenkeepers will be coming off the winter with some dead turf, you know, thin turf. The place will look barren, there'll be no leaves in the trees, there'll be scars from winter construction or possibly winter disease or autumn disease, you know, because it's never grown back. No germination in divots, people taking divots all winter, you know, still wanting to get out and play. There'll be eager golfers, especially in parkland courses and where they rope areas to keep you off the wettest parts, and then these other bits turn into a mud bath as well, and places where they can't do trolley bands or buggy bands, and there's mud everywhere. I mean, I do see some visitors turn up here from probably inland courses, and their golf shoes are white, golf shoes are brown, and they've got their waterproofs are all like a mud flap. So, yeah, I think that's really difficult, and especially we all watched Scheffler's win last night at Sawgrass. I mean, that course is just incredible. You know, it's perfection, and they all see that this time of year. It's what they call Augusta syndrome. Never suffered it for myself, but I think there'll be a lot of courses out there, the greenkeepers I know that are complain about it. You know, their members just give them a hard time. And they actually, I said, Nick Docherty talked a little bit about it last night in commentary. He was talking and saying, well, it's all down to the fact that they've got probably about 200 people working there this week, and it's all weather, you know, it's all weather related. We can all get our courses awesome. Now see some golf courses with 3-4 green staff and a shoestring budget that in the middle of July, their courses are beautiful, you know, and because the boys work so hard. But it's just all down to the weather. We ain't had that this year at all. So I can't see everyone's going to be really super happy with their courses opening this spring, you know, they'll... Greenkeepers certainly won't be. You know, we're all our worst critics, and I'm our bit's nice. It's fine, but like we've had bunkers, we've had 20 bunkers that have had full of water all winter. You know, all winter, and that devastates me. You know, I don't think it's right, and it's hard. But we're coming into the season where the grasses are all growing at different rates. You know, you've got a lot of the inland guys have got poor bent greens, and the bent grass will be slower than the poor, and then the poor will start to seed in the next month, which makes things 100 times worse.
That's a question I wanted to ask you, Bledge. So, I think links golf in general, all golf, but you know, perhaps it's for whatever reason, to my mind, maybe it's just because when I play the most of, it always seems a little more noticeable. Why in November, when, you know, when everything's dying, you know, the leaves are falling off the trees, everything's colder on average, why often are greens sort of seem better in November than they do often in April? Like when things are warming and growing, and it always seems a little counterintuitive to me. So what's the rationale behind that kind of phenomenon, and how does that explain, and what should people sort of look out for to understand that better?
Oh, I guess they've not had time to decline, have they? When it comes to November, they've been good all year. They've been well fed all year and healthy, and had, and November, there's still really good soil temperatures. You know, there's still, you could be up still 12, 13, 14 degree soil temperature in about November. Whereas coming into the spring, you've had relentless rain, you've had really short days, so high rainfall, really, really low evapotranspiration, low sunlight, cloudiness. I mean, I think this is a big thing, you know. It's like grasses, it's like humans, isn't it? I mean, we thrive and we feel happier when we see a bit of sunlight, but whenever it's cloudy and it's dank, as my mum says, dark and damp, God, it makes your bones ache, doesn't it? You know, and the grass will just be treated the exact same way. It'll be coming out of the winter just totally hacked off with life. And this is exactly it. It's just super strong going into November.
I mean, and I guess they wake up at different species, up at different rates.
And even different subspecies, different types of fescue wake up at different times, and we can use our certain types of fescue in our cultivars and our spring overseeding mix that could potentially in the year after come to life a little bit sooner. So yeah, it's a fine art. It's just, but it's a plea to the golfers about being a bit patient, you know, at this time of year, because it's hard on the greenkeepers as well, and things ain't getting any easier for us. You know, more and more chemicals are getting banned, water restrictions are getting tighter, machinery is getting more expensive, it's harder to get staff, anything else, yeah. You know, it's just daily I feel like having a mental breakdown.
Well, we'll touch on all those points, I think, in upcoming episodes, because they're all incredibly important. But the other one that you just mentioned there was soil temperature. I think that's something that probably a lot of people, when you say it, they're like, yeah, of course, that makes sense. But probably instinctively don't think about it. You know, we can go outside and go, oh, it feels warmer today. Oh, the temperature in the car on the way down to the club said it was, like I said, you know, it's, oh, it's 15 in the car today. But I guess just because the air is one temperature doesn't mean that the soil has warmed up yet. So
well,
what's the sort of magic number?
We measure the temperature.
Oh, there you go.
So in my office just now, it's 29 degrees because we put the radiator on.
Bloody hell.
I know. Sweat one. Yeah, the soil's the same. Shock. So it would be, I mean, if I was to run outside, it would probably be, I don't know, 10 degrees probably. I think it's not doing too bad just now because the grass has actually started to grow here.
Well, that's the point, I suppose, isn't it? Like water, you know, like the ocean. So, you know, where we are in the Wirral, we're surrounded by water on three sides, which means, you know, water, whilst it might seem cold in winter, it's actually keeping us warmer than most places that don't have it, because it has such a high latent heat capacity and it takes so much energy for it to change at all. I'm guessing the same is true of the soil, Bledge. You know, the deeper down you go, if you've got deeper rooted finer grasses, the kind of grasses that you want coming to life, you know, your fescues and what have you, if they've got deeper roots, then I'm guessing it takes longer for the soil at that deeper level to actually reach the temperature that means the whole plant is full systems go. Is there any truth in that?
A lot warmer further down, That's the reason now why when you're burying like irrigation pipes that we go deep enough so then they don't get frozen. But actually, I made a faux pas there, Sam. I had the cover on the end of the soil thermometer, so it's actually only 19 degrees in my office, and it's not 29. And the soil
treasurer at Hoylake will thank you for that.
I know. I've never really kind of done any kind of studies about like the correlation of temperature further down with fescue rooting or anything, but I dare say some crazy American will have done it, rooters or whatever. But I don't think soil temperature.
What temperatures is grass start growing then?
Oh God!
What temperatures is grass start growing?
Right. So for germination on a fescue, you're pretty much looking for double figures. I think we'll have double figures in ours now. We sowed the greens out 2 weeks ago, so any time now, I think we've had decent soil temperatures. We should start to see them pop in the next week. I think we're probably a week slower than that, so we might get 3 weeks worth. But I mean, it's going down fairly low at night, 5 or 6. But I mean, as you say, we had a 15-degree day today, so that'll soon heat them up. Bent grass takes a little bit more. But I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. I have a feeling it's something like 13 or 14 or 15 or something like that, but I'm not 100% sure. Someone can call me out on that. I'm not a big bent grass expert. We sow it a couple of times a year on places where we've got too much fescue and we're kind of just trying to bolster it up a little bit, and three of our old newer greens only. But certainly a lot of greenkeepers and myself included have had a lot of success in what we call cold seeding. So sowing out greens when it's the middle of winter, knowing fine well it won't pop. It just sits there until it wants to pop in start of April. So,
it's all exciting. It's coming soon. And no shortage of work for you in the meantime, I should imagine. Should we round off Bledge by telling the listeners what we're thinking with some upcoming podcasts, and
go for it.
reminding them to email in hello@golfbadgers.com and actually give us some feedback on what they'd like to hear. Well,
we've got about four different things, haven't we, that we're kind of looking at, four or five. So
yeah. So we still want to do our interviews. You know, we've got some great interviews already recorded. We've got some great people that we want to speak to. Still going to do them. However, it's certainly easier for us. And I think a lot of people have said they quite like when we just talk rubbish at each other like we have this evening. So we were thinking, well, how can we do a little more of that, but bring some structure, bring some interest, so it's not utterly mind-numbingly boring for everyone out there. And we've been thinking of the feedback that people have told us, you know, text us, emailed us, whatever, message us on social media. And I think there was one where we had a bit of an argument. We had a bit of a debate on something. I can't remember what it was, but people seemed to like it, Bledge. So that was something that we thought that we could, you know, talk about a little more. We could, a few debates, you know, links versus parkland, architecture or maintenance, you know, which is the most important, that kind of thing, and anything else that you guys might want to hear our perspectives on, whether that's us arguing the obvious side of the debate or the opposite one. And I argue why maintenance is more important than architecture, and Bledge, you could argue why architecture is more important than maintenance. You know, we could.
That'd be fun.
I'd have to really think about that one. But you know, I think that those kind of things.
It's more being an architect. That's why it's more important.
My room isn't 19 degrees. My room isn't 19 degrees, Bledge. I need to put my jumper on. Another thing that we thought is, look, many of you listening know way more about greenkeeping than I do, and probably way more about architecture and everything else as well. The thing that I've loved most about doing this podcast with you, Bledge, is the amount that I've been able to learn. And I know that there are other people who might be on a green committee, might not work in the industry, but might aspire to work in the industry, might think about changing careers, all the rest of it. And they like listening because, like me, they've learned something. So I thought that, okay, if you're an expert, maybe you're not going to be interested in this style of podcast, but a beginner's guide, you know, an idiot's guide to whatever it may be. I think questions that you've always wanted to know the answer of, or always know the answer to, but you've been too scared to ask the question. I'd imagine, Bledge, there are plenty of people out there who have a passing interest or maybe even an increasing interest in all of this subject matter, but they're too worried to actually ask, you know, how do you build a bunker? How do you build a green? You know, what are the different types of grasses? What's the difference between fescue and bent and rye? You know, what's the, why do you put sand on greens and fairways in your case at great regularity? Why do you cut down the rough over the winter? Why do you, you know, why do I want to make fairways wider? Why do I want to put bunkers in certain places from an architecture perspective? You know, stuff, what's the difference between strategic design and penal design? What's the difference between Harry Colton and Pete Dye? You know, all of these things that perhaps many of our listeners will take for granted and they'll well and truly already know the answer to, but maybe there'll be people out there who want to fire in a question and say, look, I've always wanted to know X, whatever it is.
It could be
no stupid question.
Super, super technical. It could be something about nitrogen sources or irrigation maintenance or something like that. And like, I don't always have all the answers, and you probably don't as well. So we've also got a bunch of proper experts as well that can guest and help out with this.
Well, that's brings us on to the next one I've written down here, which is our Q&A style things. And whilst when I say beginner's guides, you know, I think that's more of a stuff that we can talk on. I'd like now, rather than people with just a starting interest in the subject, but proper experts out there, proper people working in the industry. If you're a greenkeeper, if you're a head greenkeeper, if you're a member of a team, if you're a contractor, whatever you may be, if you've got a proper question, a specific question, a technical question about greenkeeping, about architecture, maybe you're a course manager at a club that would love to employ a consulting agronomist or a consulting architect, but realistically you don't have the budget, don't have the where, you know, don't have the time in the day to actually get round to that, whatever it may be. But you've got a question that you think maybe we could answer, or if it's not us, then we've actually, behind the scenes, Bledge, haven't we? We've been working away on making some big name signings.
So we've employed some Badger Cubs, haven't we?
We've employed some proper Badger experts, and we are paying them absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
But they've all agreed to do it. So I'm excited to say that if you have questions on agronomy, well, we've got news for you. We've got one of the best agronomists in the country who's going to be giving up a bit of his time to answer those questions. And if you've got questions on irrigation, you know, maybe you need to, you've got a problem with your pressure, you've got a problem with something, you've got to add something to a system. You want to put back-to-back sprinklers around your greens and you're not sure whether your system is up to scratch. Whatever it may be, we've got the man for you. And likewise, he's agreed very generously to come in every so often, as often as the questions that we have in our inbox demand of them, to come in and ask the questions. And the point that I'd love to make on this front is, if you're sat there with a question that you don't really know who to ask and you can't just pick up the phone to whoever it may be, well, the chances are there's someone else out there who's in exactly the same boat as you, with exactly the same question, with exactly the same problem, and if you actually fire your question in, then it's not just yourself who hopefully will be able to help out by doing so. It's half a dozen other people who might have the question that they haven't gotten around to asking answered for them. So that's a big one that I'm really, really excited about, Bledge, our sorts of technical Q&As. Gardener's question, Badger's question time.
Mm-hmm. Get them sent in. Let's so we can start as of the next few weeks anyway, if need be.
You know, as soon as you want. You know, we will, if you just put in your subject line question, then we will make sure that we review them all, read them all. So email them, please. And again, that's hello@golfbadgers.com. Please do send them in. So that's the other one. And then we also thought, didn't we, Bledge, that we could have some fun pods as well, every so often. People want to know what's in your bag, Bledge. People want to know...
what's in the shed? What's in the bag?
What's in the shed?
Yeah,
and our head to heads.
Well, that came about with my insomnia when I can't get to sleep at nights. And the only way to kind of to do that, I always felt, and I always used to love doing it, was have a playoff between Royal St George's and Royal Cinquefours. I'm not.
Did you ever win?
Well, I always kind of. Sometimes got to about the 16th hole and then forgot what the score was, and then that would be me sleeping. So, but I still do it quite frequently, and I kind of implore you to try it. So go for it. Do it yourselves tonight. Two clubs that are evenly matched, and go hole 1 for 1, 2 for 2, 3 for 3, and see what the score is. And you'll find it sometimes quite different. But we thought about doing that just as a bit of fun. And it would kick off quite a bit of healthy debate as well, because someone could be like, I mean, let's pick the fourth at both of these courses. God almighty, yeah. You could debate that all day.
Yeah, well...
We thought that would be a bit of fun.
Absolutely, but I think also one of the reasons I'm particularly excited to do that, Bledge, is not just as a self-indulgent exercise, but I love... Let's take Royal St George's and Deal as an example. I know, but only because I know you so well, a lot of the things that you did at Deal that maybe a lot of people hadn't quite realized. And, you know, in terms of mowing lines and in terms of routing traffic around the course, like take, for example, off the top of my head, the 16th, the mowing line left of the 16th on the par five there. To me, okay, tell me why you like it and why you did that with your course manager hat on, and describe it for the people that don't know what we're talking about.
So it was, if you missed it left on that green, there was another tee, a green tee right beside it. So it was quite dangerous. This is how it came about. We really wanted, myself and Liam Brown, the Greens chairman at the time, Liam's fantastic and had a great eye for these things as well. And we wanted to move the tee right out of there, and no better way than creating a massive big shortcut area that you could play every single goddamn shot under the sun off. You know, it was tight cut, so... and it was, we created a lovely little feature in the middle of it as well. But... I just think it was so well shaped, and it actually kind of started to change a lot of other ideas at the place. You know, I love to open places up and create flow and stuff, and
I guess from a maintenance perspective, from your side of things, Bledge, that also would have helped spread foot traffic out and
so it was huge, yeah, but yeah.
Reduce wear patterns and all the rest.
It's one of the most photographed places in the course now. I quite often see people posting pictures of it.
If I offered sort of my perspective on it with the architecture hat on, I see all of those things. You mentioned the safety there. I think that's health and safety and the sort of technical elements of course design and layout and routing traffic is a big, big part of what we... It's not all just wokey, beautiful pictures and stuff. You know, do you have your safety areas from your drive to boundaries and greens, it's a different distance. Centre of the fairway, it's a different distance. You know, we have a real duty of care in that regard, and there's a big part of that that can't be taken lightly. So as good a reason as any, if you were to make a change like that. But, you know, the thing that I love most about that is it's a greenkeeping change, isn't it? It's a decision to cut that left-hand side of the 16th green as short grass. And that is a conscious decision on your part to do that rather than have it as long, thick, rough, which a different greenkeeper might have opted for. But from an architecture point of view, it completely transforms the whole, because that's a par five. It's a par five that is really a great three-shot par five. And, you know, if the wind's against and it's a long hole, you know, it's great fun on that 16th hole because you've hit a drive. And, okay, if you've hit a really good one and the wind's not so hard and it's downwind, maybe you can go for the green and two. But if you're playing it as a three-shot hole because you're slightly out of position or the wind's against or whatever, you make a decision on that second shot whether you go down the wider right-hand side and have a blind pitch up the slope, or can you get it down the higher left-hand side that you added in, didn't you, Bledge? You grew in and have a sighted, visible pitch shot from equal grade across to the green. So it's a beautiful sort of conundrum that's set. But the reason why I think that greenkeeping choice really inspires the architecture of the hole is the players who are in position to go for the green and two, it completely makes that shot, because it's always, you know, unless maybe you're George Donahue or something, it's always going to be really right at the edge of your range, isn't it, Bledge? It's a long it's a long par five to get up in two shots anyway. So if you're going for it in two, with the road quite close to the right-hand side and some gnarly rough to the right-hand side, if you miss that green right, the juxtaposition between, oh, Christ, I don't want to miss it right, and, well, hang on a minute, now that Bledge and Liam have started cutting it shorter down the left-hand side, all of a sudden, I'd rather miss left than miss right. So what happens? Well, most players now, rather than aim for the middle of the green, if they've pulled their three wood, they'll probably aim, Bledge, I'd say, for the left-hand side of the green, because that is the safe side to miss it on. But by doing so, if you're a really good player, and realistically it's the really good players who are going for that green in two, the really good players now, you've actually encouraged them to not even aim for the green. You've actually encouraged them to miss the green by making it easier over there. And whilst it's easier in that you find your ball, it's not easy to get up and down from there, is it? Because as you say...
Not on a left cut pin as well, you know. There's so many... I mean, the left pins up there are just the scorecard records, because you're just tonking it miles through, you know, or you try and get cute with it and it ends up coming back down the slope. But we did the same at 17 as well. But the kind of whole point is, this is the things we can debate against what 16 holes better and stuff, you know, and come up with a grand score. Just as long, I'll tell you right now, I shall not be doing Hoylake. I'm not losing a job over this.
You can do Wallasey, I'll take Hoylake. But I think that's, I think, well, there you go. There's one that we can debate, because the 16th green, that beautiful par three, absolutely gorgeous par three at Royal St. George's that cost, what's his face? Who was it? Was it Thomas Bjorn?
Thomas Bjorn bunker. Yeah. He left it in.
Well, I think that's an interesting example, actually, Bledge, because I sat behind that green in the big grandstand in the Open in 2021, was it? I can't even remember when that was rescheduled.
Darren Clark.
No, the recent one that...
Sorry,
it was Darren Clark who won that in 2003. Anyway, but the interesting thing there is, because you created that asymmetry on 16 at Deal with a disastrous miss on the right-hand side and a 50%, you know, up and down at best on the left-hand side, I think that you encourage people to miss the green. Whereas I sat behind the 16th green at Royal St. George's and I watched every single group who came through hit their shots to the exact middle of the green. And I went there on different days and there were different pin positions, and you could have put a beach towel and laid it down in the middle of the 16th green, and with no wind, I reckon 80% of the that's probably a ridiculous stat, a ridiculous claim. But anyway, the vast majority of all shots ended up right in the middle, because the player's intent, where they're looking to aim their shot, because it's sort of so risky all the way around that green, they actually don't aim to miss the green, as in the case of the 16th at Deal, because you're giving them an easy side and a hard side. If every side is the hard side, they just aim for the middle and they back themselves to hole a 12-foot putt. Whether the pin is right, they've got a 12-footer from the middle of the green to the right towards beyond bunker. If it's left, they're going the other way. If it's forward, whatever it is. So I think that it's a good example of how actually making one side of a hole slightly easier and not having thick rough in the case of your hole there, but having short grass actually makes the hole harder, because you're encouraging people to miss the green. So
it makes it a lot better in many respects, I think, aesthetically, playability, everything. Yeah, especially being a match play golf course. But these, we can, we'll debate this in short form. 1 minute debate, 1 minute to speak each per hole. Might be a nice little episode. But yeah, that's, and is that our last idea?
Well, I think so. I think there's a couple of others that didn't quite make the cutting room floor, and we've gone on now long enough. But if anyone else likewise has any further ideas, anything else that they think we should throw into the mix, then, you know, email that in too. But we really, really want to carry on doing this podcast, because so many of you have said how you've enjoyed it, and we're always a bit surprised and very grateful, aren't we, Bledge? So anyone who has any ideas or thoughts on those suggestions, please do get in touch, because we'd love to hear from you.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to, we'll release this episode and then they'll be followed by a few guests, and then
we'll get
stand by for some different episodes on your way soon. So Absolutely. Everyone have a good week, and look forward to your golf courses opening in the spring.
Absolutely. Don't expect too much.
There we go.
Well, thanks, Bledge. Thank you. Looking forward to seeing you soon, and take care.
Cool. Good night.